Hello everyone. So welcome to the Strong Gratitude Seminar this week. The speaker today is Bing Zhang. Dr. Zhang is a distinguished professor at the Department of Physics and Astronomy of University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Dr. Zhang is well known for his work in high energy astrophysics, including many recent work on faster radio bursts, both the physical mechanisms and also the applications. Today, I think Dr. Zhang will talk about the physical mechanisms of FRBs. And yeah, please take it away.
Okay, thanks, Juan. Let me share the screen now. Thank you very much for the invitation, and it's my pleasure to give a remote talk. So last time I visited Canada was back in 2003 when I visited ETA. So it's a long time ago. So I really hope that this could be like a physical visit, but hopefully pandemic will be over. And sometimes I can get a chance to visit you guys another time. So as Juan introduced, I'm going to talk about the physical mechanisms of fast radio bursts. And he told me that the audience may not be, you definitely know FRBs, but may not be know that much detail. So I put a little bit more introduction here in the talk. So before discussing the physical mechanisms, I'll start with the observational properties, because this is how to constrain theoretical models. There are many excellent reviews here listed, and including my own review, which is this talk is based on. And so basically, the starting point is FRBs have short durations. They are in the radio band, and they're typically duration is milliseconds. This immediately give a length scale multiplied by C. So this is 3 × 10⁷ centimeters, which means something related to compact objects, either neutron stars or stellar type black holes could be the source. Of course, there are other models in the literature, but they need to somehow to break this constraint to invoke a very small patch of the objects to do the radiation. And repetition. We now know that at least some FRB sources repeat, and probably maybe the majority of them are repeaters, if not all. I'll come back to this later. So the main reason is that the event rate of FRBs is just so high. Most of the catastrophic events in the universe do not have that large event rate density to power FRBs. So this is a very indirect argument saying that probably the majority or all the FRBs repeat. Some of them have very high repetition rate. However, there are observationally, there are indeed like, looks like appear like there are two subtypes, because there are some bursts like the Lorimer burst, the very first one. There were extensive follow-up observations, 190 hours more than later got observed again, so never repeated. And some of them, like the very first one, this guy, Tau-1102, they're very active. And Chime made more observations, and they did some statistical analysis and showing that the width or the duration of FRBs seems to be also slightly different. So you can see the orange bar, the histograms are the four repeaters, and this narrow blue bar is for the non-repeaters. So the non-repeaters might be narrower than the repeaters. So still an open question for now. Periodicity, this is also very curious. because if these guys are related to neutron stars, and one would expect that there should be a spinning period of from milliseconds to seconds, as we see for the neutron stars in our galaxy. However, the extensive search for such kind of periodicity in this range resulted in nothing. So basically, there's no period in that region. However, quite surprisingly, for this Trime source, there was a roughly 16-day period. This was the observations discovered by Trime and confirmed by other telescopes. There are indeed these active windows during which FRBs occur, and in other off active windows, there's nothing observed, even though there are observations. And there is also a trend that this window is frequency dependent. It seems like the higher frequency ones arrive earlier in the window and the low frequency ones arrive later. So this is also puzzling. And for the very first FRB source, 12-1102, there was also a roughly 160-day period reported. So this is something puzzling. For individual birds themselves, there are typical frequencies. Now we actually observe from 300 megahertz all the way to 8 gigahertz. The spectral index, the spectrum may not be a power law, but if you really assume it is a power law, the spectral index could be very different. Just for this first repeater, it could vary from minus 10 to plus 14. So which means very likely the spectrum is narrow. You are seeing the left side of the spectrum, it will make you a positive index, and then the right-hand side with the negative index. There are also internal structure and scattering tails. If you look at the light curves, for example, this one, you clearly see multiple peaks. And also, if you break down, this is especially for repeaters, break down these peaks, and it turns out that higher frequency ones arrive earlier and lower frequency ones arrive later. So this is called a frequency downdrifting, and sometimes we call a sad trombone effect. For polarizations, the properties are mixed. Some of them got nearly 100% linear polarization, and some others have low polarization degree. However, the low polarization degree may not mean that the true polarization degree is really low. For example, this very first one, initially, it got a very low polarization. However, that was because the rotation measure is so large. Once you properly take care of the correction, then it turns out to be 100% linear polarization. And the polarization angle also, the properties are also diverse. For 12-1102, you can see that during each burst, the polarization angle actually remains roughly constant. This was regarded as a support of certain models, but later on, some of the non-repeating birds started to see the varying polarization angles. And very recently, this is another repeater actually show diverse polarization angle swings. So again, it's quite puzzling. I'll come back to this later. And the polarization angle also rotate as a frequency that's called Faraday rotation. And this RM is typically larger than radio pulsars. And in particular, this guy has a very large RM, 10 to the fifth power, so very large. And RM actually has been observed to have variations, both secular and the short-term variations. DM, that is the how from first the space people started to guess that they are cosmological, because the dispersion measure is the integral of the column density, well, the volume density along the line of sight. So it is based on column density. And you can see that these DMs are much higher than the galactic values. So there are extra free electrons along the line of sight and very likely coming from the IGM. If we believe that the majority of the DM is from the IGM, then one can estimate the redshift from much less than one all the way to greater than three. There are some FRBs now have been localized. So they have two measured redshifts and they sit in this range and looks like they are indeed, there is a positive correlation between redshift and the DM. And there are several different models talking about this coefficient from ranging from 1200 early on by Iuka, 1000 from Inouye, and we said it's less than 900. And it turns out that this number seemed to match the current data very well if you deduct some standard host galaxy DM contribution. Okay, with redshift, with distance, one can start to estimate the luminosity of the FRBs and the energy of the FRBs because you don't know the beaming factor. So what you can do is to estimate the isotropic values. So for luminosity and energy, they are in this range, typical value 10 to 42 ergs per second, 10 to 39 erg for typical distance, yeah, the cosmological distance. And this is for Jansky millisecond FRB. So there's a, of course, there's a range of distribution, peak luminosity range from 10 to 38 all the way to 10 to 46. So this is already eight orders magnitudes. And isotropic energy also vary in a wide range. So if we consider a beaming effect, the true luminosity and energy should be smaller by this factor FB, which is the solid angle divided by 4 pi. If FB is there, then there should be a lot more FRBs, which we don't see. So event rate will go up. Energy for each burst will go down, but the total energy released from all the bursts remain the same because those two factors cancel out. And with the luminosity and the duration, one can calculate something called brightness temperature. In radio astronomy, this actually, it is a imaginary temperature. There is definitely is not true temperature. And it turns out that it's a huge number. Before FRBs, pulsars had a very high brightness temperature of order of 10 to the 26, 28. But now FRBs give another 10 orders of magnitude boost in terms of brightness temperature. And according to plasma physics, this brightness temperature actually requires that the radiation mechanism must be coherent. This is the global properties. So they come from high galactic latitudes, isotropic and non-Euclidean. So it's consistent to be cosmological. This is a GRB distribution in the sky. This is the FRB distribution in the sky. So they are consistent with each other. The observed event rate, if we limit ourselves to Jansky millisecond level, in all sky is ranged from 1,000 to 10,000 per day. Observationally, of course, you don't detect that many because our radio telescope have a narrow field of view. But imagine you have an all sky monitor, every day you will get thousands of them. If we go down the fluence, there are even more. This is the observed one. One can convert that to the true physical one. So this is called the event rate density or volumetric event rate per unit volume per unit time. And it turns out that it, of course, it depends on the luminosity. Above 10 to the 42, it is 35,000. Basically, this is a very large number. For neutron star mergers, it's about order of 1,500. So again, FB will change things. If FB is there, the true rate should be even higher than this. And because they spread out in eight orders of magnitude, one can also fit the energy or luminosity distribution. Several papers reached a similar conclusion. So basically, it is a power law distribution with the index of minus 1.8. It could be a more complicated function. There could be a high energy cutoff, there could be a low energy cutoff, or another component. I'll come back to those later. The redshift distribution currently is not known. One thing is clear, no evolution model, for example, FRBs equally distributed in space, evenly distributed in space, is already ruled out. However, whether they track the star formation rate, it is consistent with star formation history. However, for compact object mergers, it's also have extra delay. So that distribution is also not ruled out. So basically, no evolution model is particularly disfavored at this point because the available sample is too small. I believe Chime will release a huge amount of data pretty soon, and this question will be addressed quickly. Okay, so that's all for the observations. And now we come to the physical mechanisms. Because we don't really know what is going on for FRBs, what we can do is to look at the relatives of FRBs, which we do know what is going on. So the two neighboring fields are the field of gamma ray bursts and the field of the radio pulsars. Actually, many theorists working on FRBs came from these two fields. FRBs and GRBs, whether there was a physical connection, I wrote the earlier paper suggesting there was a physical connection, but now it is not confirmed. So we have a big question mark here. However, I think they're all more connected through cultural similarities between the two fields. Just look at these two plots. If you forget about this is in the radio, this is in the gamma rays, we are dealing with some short duration bursting behaviors. And the approach of understanding the two phenomena are quite similar. So this was a historical comparison between these two fields. They basically went through these four stages addressing these four questions. The very first one was, are they astrophysical? For GRBs, it took 5 to 6 years, and for FRBs, it also took a similar amount of time until after the first one, there were confusion about the peritons, something artificial, and eventually there were new FRBs detected and the peritons were resolved as a microwave of an origin. So that was when it was established that FRBs are astrophysical. And then are there multiple types? With GRBs, early on, we know there are repeaters and non-repeaters. And in 1992, start to split them to long and short. For FRBs, we do know that there are repeaters, but right now we are still struggling whether they are all repeaters or there are another non-repeating sources. Where are they? For GRBs, it took several steps. Actually, the localization took a long time. 30 years after discovery, long GRBs were localized, and another 15 years, short GRBs were localized. For FRBs, actually, it happened very quickly once the first repeater was discovered, and the VLBI observation actually can pin down the location with the radio detection only. So very quickly, we know that FRBs are cosmological, and very recently, there was also a galactic FRB. This is thanks to the high event rate of FRBs. So if you wait long enough, then there should be an FRB happening in our own galaxy. What makes them? This is a very difficult question to answer. And for GRBs, again, it took many years. Because people have been waiting for smoking gun signatures. For example, for long GRBs, it was until the detection of supernova associated with long GRBs when people realized, okay, long GRBs are coming from the massive star core collapse. And for short GRBs, it was until the detection of the first gravitational wave associated with short GRB to know that there are neutrons and neutrons and mergers. And for FRBs, I was quite pessimistic in the past because I thought at the cosmological distances, there's just a lack of smoking gun signatures. They're very far away and they don't have very bright EM counterparts. However, it was quite surprising that we did observe one FRB in our galaxy, and we know that it was from a magnetar. So we know that at least magnetars can make FRBs. Whether all the FRBs are made by magnetars is still an open question. One slide for afterglow, because for GRBs, the afterglow, which is lower frequency, fainter emission, was very important to constrain the physical properties. If we consider FRBs as similar explosions, then we would say, okay, how about the afterglow? This could be quickly estimated. So because FRBs are both shorter and more importantly, the total energy is much smaller because it's in the radio band and GBR in the gamma ray band. So the isotropic emission energy differ by 12 to 13 orders of magnitude. That is a huge difference. If we plug in the standard afterglow model, it turns out that they're very, very faint. Detectable only if FRBs have very low efficiency in radio, which means there's a lot of energy goes to the X-rays, and they have to be very nearby. So far there's no such kind of detection. This slide is an incomplete list of what make them, no particular order. There are repeating models, catastrophic models. This was an earlier slide. There are a lot of more models here. And there was an online wiki page for FRB theories. You can see more than 50 models are listed there. But the lessons from the GRBs is in the GRB field, there were more than 100 models back then. And this was the famous quote of Melvin Rudman, the only feature that all but one and perhaps all of the very many proposed models have in common is that they will not be the explanation of GRBs. It's simply because there are, nature cannot have 100 ways of making GRBs. The same may be stated for FRBs. It is impossible to have 50 ways of creating FRBs. However, there could be three ways, five ways. So if we are optimistic enough. And those are the cultural connection and physical connection. There is one subtype of GRB models. Well, for GRBs, we talk about the relativistic jets. We have internal shocks, we have external shocks. And these shocks are making gamma rays. However, back in the GRB, early years of GRB studies, some people started to think, okay, how about making some synchrotron maser radio emission? Some early papers were Waxman, Wusoff. Then they could probably make some coherent radio emission. But such kind of prediction was never realized because in GRBs, we didn't see anything like FRB. However, this idea was revoked in the FRB era. So a lot of studies showing that synchrotron maser process in these shocks, both internal and external, can make something like a bright radio emission, like an FRB. This is the other neighboring field, radio pulsars. This one we are more familiar with because we know that they are galactic, they are spinning neutron stars, and we do know that they are radiating high brightness temperature radio emission. So this is the famous Crab pulsar. The Crab pulsar has two main components. This is the radio light curve this is a folded radio light curve for each period. So there are three components. There are two bright ones. It turns out that these two bright ones are aligned with the high energy emission from the gamma rays, X-rays, and optical. So we know that these guys coming from outer part of magnetosphere, so either so-called outer gap or slot gap, or even the current sheet outside the light cylinder. So there are different models for that. But because this radio component aligns with high energy emissions. So we know that the outer part of the pulsar magnetosphere can produce radio emission. And there is another component. This component, if we do the geometry, is quite consistent with the emission from the inner magnetosphere, the polar cap region, open field line region. This is for Crab pulsar, which is a very young pulsar. If we go to, oh, I missed one slide. If we go to older pulsars, it seems like a majority of them seems to come from the open field line region. So we also know that the inner magnetosphere can also make bright radio emission. And for FRB models, there are 50 of them. However, for all these models, we can decompose the model components to two parts. One is to address the coherent radiation mechanism, and the other is to address the source models. And the 50 models, actually, we're talking about different sources. Actually, many different source models share more or less similar to the coherent radiation mechanism models. So I split them into two and discuss them in turn. So we start with the coherent radiation mechanisms. And within this part of the modeling, there are two subcategories. One invokes the magnetosphere of neutron star. The other invokes some shocks outside the magnetosphere. So this is more like a GRB model. This is more like a pulsar model. And within each model, there are different ways of creating coherent radio emission. In the pulsar model, there are antenna model, like a bunch of the pairs, and there are also masers, both plasma maser and the vacuum maser. And for outside the magnetosphere, we also maser models for plasma and the vacuum, respectively. So this is another view of these two models, pulsar-like or magnetosphere model. So FRBs are believed to be produced inside somewhere in the magnetosphere. In this particular model, it's from open field line region. And this is the outside magnetosphere from shocks. These two models, there are many papers in the literature. They have somewhat different predictions. For the pulsar-like model, for the magnetosphere model, because we are invoking magnetic field lines, so very likely the emission beam should be narrow, just like radio pulsars. But for shock models, probably the beaming angle is wide because we do not have a collimation mechanism. For GRBs, the jets are not that wide. That is because we do have something to collimate the jet. For long GRBs, we have a massive star. For short GRB, we have some ejecta surrounding the merger remnant. But if we have a magnetar out there, if you launch a relativistic outflow, very likely it is very wide. In the radio efficiency for pulsar-like models, radio efficiency is probably relatively high, which means there's not much energy in the other wavelength, energy bands for X-ray and gamma rays. Probably it's 100 times or 1,000 times. But for this one, radio efficiency is very low. There should be more emission from the X-ray and the gamma ray band, maybe 10 to 4 or 10 to 5th. But there are rooms for these models to match a certain observation. So high energy counterparts, this one has a moderately bright, this one has a bright emission component. It may not be easy to differentiate the two models with these observations. However, polarization properties are the key. For example, if we are invoking a pulsar-like mechanism, because we're talking about the magnetosphere, and the star is rotating, our line of sight may sweeping and maybe sweeping across the emission beam. So it could produce either, it could produce high linear polarization degree because the strong B field. For the polarization angle, it can produce either non-varying or diverse swings of polarization angles. For non-varying is probably related to magnetosphere, outer magnetosphere, when the field lines are very straight and probably the star is not rotating rapidly. So during the burst, you see a straight line of PA. If the emission comes from the inner magnetosphere and the star might, if the star is rotating faster, you start to see the variation of the polarization angle. For the Maser model, for the shock model, there are two subtypes. One type, there's no polarization at all if it is hydro. If it is a strongly B-field magnetized shock, in that case, one can produce 100 linear polarization. However, because the B field has to be parallel to the plane of the shock front, so in that case, one should always see a constant linear polarization angle and not varying. So this is a potential difference between the two models. So the observationally, when this guy was discovered, this was 12.11.02, the very first repeater, you can see the polarization angles are indeed flat. Then this model is very popular. And of course, this model, magnetosphere model, as long as we have some outer magnetosphere, some straight lines, this could also interpret the data. However, when we start to see this varying polarization angles across the bursts, so this is a, these are some non-repeating bursts, then one probably needs to have a magnetosphere model. Back then, this happened in repeater, this happened in non-repeaters, and people say, oh, might be a difference in terms of polarization properties between the two. Until this guy was discovered, this was a new repeater discovered by using the FAST 500 meter telescope in China. And these are the bursts from the same source. And you can see that during the burst, and there are a lot of features. And the polarization angle in this way, this one is roughly flat, this one is rising, this one is dropping, this one is flat and rising, this is up and down. So there are diverse patterns. So in this case, a magnetosphere origin is much more favored than shock. And there's another observation by FAST, the currently under review. So this 12.11.02, again, the very first one. This one was detected by FAST 2 years ago now. Within 40, 50 days, we detected 47 days, we detected more than 1,500 bursts. There are so many of them. And one can really start to look at the luminosity function. Indeed, at the higher end, it is a power law, but there are other features, and there might be an additional component coming in at lower frequency and energies. And the waiting time is also very interesting. There's a bimodal distribution. There's a long waiting time, about 100 seconds. This one could be interpreted in both models. However, there's also a short peak of milliseconds, several milliseconds, which means that after a burst, before long, there's another one coming out. This one is again very troublesome for shock models, because after every shock, the ejecta needs to cool down in order to have another bright burst, and B field might be distorted. And in order to maintain that order B field, it is hard to do it like consecutively for many times within milliseconds. So this to me is another piece of information supporting the magnetosphere origin of the burst. So there are many possible ways of generating magnetosphere coherent radiation. This is one of them. There are multiple papers discussing this particular mechanism, that is the bunch of the pairs. So this was the old model in the pulsar theories by Rudman and Sutherland. It has been criticized by Melrose and recently by Lubarsky by different reasons. For example, the bunch, whether a bunch can form and maintain, or the plasma effect might suppress the brightness of the radio emission. However, this model was revived in the FRB field, there are several papers. There was a paper by Kumar, Pawan Kumar et al. The key point here is that because the FRB cooling rate is very high, in order to produce FRB, there must be a parallel electric field along the field line. So with this requirement, then some of these criticisms we have to reinvestigate. So Yuan Peiyang and myself, we did some 3D coherent bunch studies. The recent development is that Kumar and Bosniak are suggesting that there's alpha wave propagating to a large enough radius and charge starving start to happen. The entrain charge density becomes smaller than the required charge for Goldgrass Julian. And in that case, there are the E parallel, and the E parallel start to accelerate bunches and make FRBs. And there could be a charge separation with the existence of the E field. There could be a charge separation which will impact the spectrum of the FRB emission. Of course, this is one of the many models. I just mentioned this one. It is not the final story yet. For this particular model, actually, it is quite useful to explain this down drifting of the emission as a function of frequency, simply because if you start to invoke multiple sparks, bunches, and they're sliding along the field lines, when your line of sight start to observe these sparks or bunches, you always see the lower ones first, and then at a later time, they see the higher ones. And when they move outwards, the curvature radius increases, the frequency goes down. So you always see such kind of patterns. So this is a standard radius for frequency mapping in the pulsar magnetic field. Okay, so this is so far.
Oh, sorry, so what is the emission mechanism? Are you talking about curvature radiation?
Yeah, curvature radiation for this particular model. Yeah, but there are also other models to invoke the plasma instabilities.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm not betting on this one. I'm just saying that this is one of the ways to produce radio emission. Now we move on to source models. So again, there are two types of models, repeating models and non-repeating models. For repeaters, we do know magnetars, but there are many other suggestions, for example, involving pulsars, black holes, interacting models. For non-repeating ones, we have CBCs, compact binary coalescence, blitzars, and other models. Before this event, and all those possibilities are wide open, but now we settled on this at least for some of them. This was the association with FRB 200428. It was associated with an SGR, a galactic magnetar, and not only associated with that source, but associated with one of the high energy hard X-ray or soft gamma ray burst. So this FRB had two peaks, and it turns out that X-ray light curve also have two sharp peaks. If we correct for the dispersion delay, it turns out that these two peaks seems to align with those two peaks roughly. And STER2 only detect the second one, but they are all consistent with coming from the source. So we now know that at least some FRBs are produced by magnetars. How to do that? There are some other ideas, but this is our favorable idea. So it could be something related to crust, maybe crust cracking, star quake, and sending out some waves. So in the crust, it takes a while to propagate to the open field line regions, but in the closed field line regions, these alpha waves will heat up the plasma, but the plasma is not going anywhere. So here is the where Comptonized hard X-rays happen. And In open field line regions, the alpha waves start to propagate until reaching certain distance and start to produce curvature radiation with a E parallel. We also coordinated observation with FAST. So actually we did it before FR, way before the FRV happened, because I think magnetars has been a top guess, top possibility for FRBs. So once it became active, we started to monitor the source using FAST, and we also coordinated some X-ray optical and gamma ray observations. And it turns out that before the same day, but before FRB 2004-28 happened, there was another episode during which there were 29 gamma ray bursts or hard X-ray bursts were emitted. However, we had a very deep non-detection. So if there is any FRB, not even FRB, any radio burst, it should happen around this time, depending on the DM. But the DM, we know it should happen here, but nothing was discovered. So this, because FAST is very sensitive, it gave very stringent flux fluence upper limits. So this is quite puzzling why that particular burst made a very bright FRB and all the others made not even a radio pulse. So there could be three possibilities: narrow beaming or narrow spectrum, wrong frequency, or the SGR burst is special. So for all these, we investigate. This one is essentially ruled out. The parameter range is so small. Narrowly beamed emission is possible, but the Lorentz factor has to be greater than certain value, and this data has to be smaller than certain value. So there's a constraint on the beaming factor there. But there are also papers saying that that particular X-ray burst looks very special. There are two peaks, hard peaks, and the cutoff energy is higher. So that probably be the reason. For if it is the FRB emission is beamed, then there could be something I call slow radio bursts. So just like it for GRBs, we have high luminosity gamma ray bursts. We also have low luminosity gamma ray bursts, very likely viewed from an angle outside the narrow beam. So actually, the 1708-17, the famous short GRB observed associated with the double neutron star merger, was a GRB viewed outside the at a large viewing angle. So if FRBs are similarly narrowly beamed, one should be able to see something else, some longer duration, lower luminosity bursts, which I call SRBs. So these are some basic derivations. So the key point is the Doppler factor, which is defined this way, 1/(-) beta cosine theta. And if it is on beam, the Doppler factor is 2 gamma, but if it's off beam, the Doppler factor becomes smaller. And you can see the frequency is scales with, if we assume that in the commoving frame, everything is the same, the observed new should be higher for on beam case, lower for off beam case, and duration should be longer for off beam and luminosity is lower. So we can actually derive something called closure relations. So this must be connecting two events. One is a on-beam FRB, the other is off-beam SRB. So there's the flux width and the nu should satisfy these relations depending on the spectrum of the FRB, whether it's the power law or a Gaussian law. And I also tested some of the weaker bursts detected from the same SGR. There's one of them particularly appealing, that looks like an SRB to me. And the others could be made, the case could be made, but may not be real. So we still need to have a lot more studies trying to constrain these, because the number of SRBs depending on whether it is beam and the beaming angle. If the beaming angle is narrow, then one should see a lot of SRBs than FRBs. If the beaming angle is very wide, then there's not that many SRBs. So we need a coordinated campaign and theoretical modeling to figure this out. So open questions, there are a lot, and here I just list.
In this picture, so what makes a pulsar different from FRB or SRB, basically? What's the difference?
Yeah, the pulsar flux is still much, much lower than FRB and SRBs, because this for the galactic FRB, the flux is mega Jansky. And for pulsars, pulse emission, it is typically millisecond. Actually, we use FAST to monitor this one. We detect a lot of pulsar-like emission. They are definitely not like they're intermediate bright radio bursts with the luminosity between FRB and the radio pulsars.
Right, but could it be that, pulsar, if you're off angle, then it looks like a pulsar, but if you're exactly on angle, then it looks like FRB. Basically the same with SRB versus FRB. Isn't that possible? Like if you're even farther off, then it would be a pulsar.
That's a possibility, but these guys are quite erratic and very bright. So if within that picture, we should see periodicity for the very active FRBs, for example, 1102. We didn't see that. So I would still differentiate between bursts and pulses. The pulses are the regular pattern and the lower luminosity. Mm-hmm. Bursts are randomly happening in different phases, and I think they have different origins.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. And back to the open questions, where is FRB emission generated? So from the magnetosphere or shock? And to me, there's already strong evidence in favor of the magnetosphere, but the shock models are still being developed. What is a coherent mechanism? This one is even more difficult to answer because there are more than a dozen of models out there. Are there engines other than magnetars that power FRBs? If so, what could be the plausible sources? And what's the original FRB periodicity, 16-day periodicity, binary system precession? Are there generally non-repeating FRBs? If so, what could be the plausible sources? I'll quickly go over some of these. For the first one, I think I already mentioned, but now this second one, are there engines other than magnetars? So there are two extreme views. I would imagine nature probably lying between. So the most conservative picture is that magnetars can do everything. So we do know that regular magnetars, like the magnetars in our own galaxy, can make regular repeaters like the one we observe. And then we can extend this to all the others FRBs in the universe. We are saying that, okay, those non-repeat, so-called apparently non-repeating ones, they're also repeating, but they are probably regular repeaters. There could be also active repeaters out there, which repeat a lot, and those could be produced by some special magnetars produced from the long GRB, short GRB, or supernova event. So they are still highly rapidly spinning with a much stronger B field, and they emit more FRBs. So this is the most conservative picture. This picture so far is okay. So it does not contradict with the data, but we have to accept that fact that there are indeed some special magnetars which do not exist in our own galaxy because we don't have a very active FRB repeater. If we do have a very special magnetar, we should detect a lot of joint FRBs during a very short period of time, but we only detected one so far. Okay, and there's another extreme. There are the most speculative picture of FRBs. In this picture, we do have repeaters. We do have generally non-repeaters. And for repeaters, besides magnetars, there could be something else. And for non-repeating ones, we have, say, compact star merger with blazars. So this is very speculative. Probably this won't be realized because there are many of these possibilities, but I think if we go to the conservative one, we probably underestimate the creativity of nature. So I would imagine something in between. So in this picture, I highlight these green boxes. They are all related to gravitational waves, because if FRBs are from the most FRBs are from cosmological distances, we do not have smoking gun signatures unless they are associated with gravitational waves. So these models do predict the association of gravitational waves with certain FRBs. So this is before merger or shortly after merger. There are a lot of things going on that could be a one-off very bright FRB. I want to emphasize this one, neutron star merger, pre-merger interaction. This is also a repeater model. So I had a paper, I think Juan also had a paper. So basically, decades to centuries before the merger, the two neutron stars are already interacting. Then interaction probably will drive some reconnection events and so on and so forth, and probably will make repeating FRBs. And Juan's model was trying to interpret the periodicity with such kind of binary merger. So in this case, repeating FRBs should be associated with long wavelength gravitational waves detectable by, say, LISA, Tianqing, or Taiji, some future space gravitational wave detectors. So that is something remain to be seen in 2030s. Hopefully, one of the repeaters are associated with some gravitational wave sources that will pin down this origin. Origin of the periodicity in the literature, there are two broad types. One invokes binaries, and 16-day period might be the binary period. The other invokes the precession of the magnetar, and this is Juan's model. And the precession period is about 16 days. So there are still a lot of research going on too. So both models, actually, I would say that there are pros and cons, and this period is actually not predicted in these models, but when the observation became available, one can really make a model to make it work. So still, remain to be seen that whether all the FR repeating FRB sources have periods, or whether these periods will maintain for a long period of time. So future will tell. Regarding whether or not there are genuinely non-repeating FRBs besides the theoretical modeling, there's a way to tell this. We just monitor the fraction of the observed repeaters. So CHIM is detecting more and more repeaters and more non-repeaters. So that fraction, according to different models, actually, there's an evolution. So if there's no repeaters at all, that fraction should continuously go up because you will eventually see more and more repeaters. So the repeater fraction will go up. However, if there are indeed some non-repeaters, that curve will start to flatten. So there might be a peak there. So this is a long-term project, but in principle, that is a way to tell whether there are generally non-repeaters. Okay, so this is the final slide, summary. So coherent radio emission models, there are two locations, magnetospheres versus shocks. And the coherent magnets, there are bunched curvature radiation, the other plasma instabilities, there's a long way to go. The blue color is my own favorite possibility. Source models, most conservative magnetars do it all, and most speculative repeaters and non-repeaters both exist, and there are multiple progenitors in both. And there could be a gravitational wave connection. A future prospects, from the observations and theories, from observations, I think the major breakthrough came from the detection of galactic FRBs. So probably in the future also, if another galactic FRB is detecting our own from something else in our own galaxy, well, it might very likely it will come from another magnetar or this same magnetar. But if it comes from, say, galactic center or from other some X-ray binaries, then we immediately know that there could be other sources that can make FRBs. Searching for slow radio bursts, SRBs from magnetar may offer a clue regarding binary. And multi-messenger observations didn't actually hold the key to identify or eliminate models invoking those mergers. From the theoretical aspect, the debate on coherent magnetism will continue and the magnetar physics will be studied even more. Okay, that's all. Thank you very much and open to answer some questions.
Okay, thank you all for the very nice talk. Any questions?
Yes, Professor Zhang. I'm confused about the coherent mechanism. You mentioned the bunched curvature radiation or plasma instabilities. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering in your Sedaquik model, how does the Sedaquik, how does this, I mean, in this model, how does the Sedaquik relate to the coherent emission?
Oh, the quake itself just sends some oscillations, which will be transferred to Alfvén waves in the magnetosphere. And Alfvén waves will propagate in both closed field line regions and open field line regions. And in closed field line regions, it acts as a heating mechanism to upscatter the X-rays. But in open field line region, Alfvén wave will eventually reach a distance where charge starvation will happen. And you start to have the parallel E field. That way you can continuously pump energy into the bunches to make a bright enough FRB to be observed. So in principle, some curvature radiation should still happen here, but the power is so low. So only when this charge starvation happens, one can start to make very bright FRB image.
Can you follow up on that question? So pulsars we only see relatively close by.
Mm-hmm.
So for this, for C95B as cosmological distances, the engine is still the same. It's not much more energetic. The field is stronger, but not crazily stronger. So what conspires for us to see this object so energetically that it's so different from a pulsar that we only see nearby?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So in this particular picture, it is related to the large electric field. Of course, the ultimate source is from the magnetic energy. So we need to deposit a lot of energy from the star. So that is will make the first difference between a FRB and a radio pulsar. The radio pulsar, we actually just consume the spin down luminosity, which is typically not large enough to make FRBs. So first, there's a trigger of dissipating a huge amount of magnetic energy. The second, in terms of converting that energy to the radio emission, we do need a parallel E field to continuously pump energy into the bunches to make bright FRBs.
Hey, Professor Zhang, thanks for the talk. I have a question. So about this charge starvation, I saw that you also mentioned my paper with Alex Chen.
Yeah.
So mainly in our simulation, we just say like when this charge starvation takes place, there's just no bunches can be formed. So this, so just from that, this is not a kind of a viable mechanism to form these bunches for the coherent emission.
Yeah, and thanks for raising that. I think I read your paper and also a paper by Alex Chen. I think the main criticism is that the charge starvation region may not happen at all, right?
Yeah. So mainly the alpha waves, when they propagate, they will stream the kind of the charges along together with it. So yeah, if you enter in the charge starvation, it would just accelerate these particles and to very high Lorentz factor and keeps moving with the alpha waves.
Yes, yes, yes. So because you did the simulation, you know the things very well. I think Pawan Kumar and Wenbin Lu also we discussed about this, and remain to be seen that because you probably just simulate a short, there's one propagation of one alpha wavelength. It would be interesting to see whether in the long run, long term, whether something will happen. Of course, if eventually you say that this is impossible, then we have to give up this particular model. So as I said from the very beginning, I'm not betting on this. I'm just saying that this model has some interesting features that can interpret, say, for example, the downdrifting of the radio pulses and other features.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Well, maybe I can ask one. So at the end of your talk, you were discussing how do you find the non-repeaters. So I was a little bit lost because you went over fast. So can you just...
If we continue to monitor the same sky over and over and over, because a repeater is defined whenever the second burst is detected from the same region. So if there's no, say, no fundamentally non-repeaters, no genuine non-repeaters, if you observe long enough, then everything will become repeaters. So maybe after a year, after 10 years, the other guys start to repeat again. So this is why this observed fraction of the repeaters should continuously increase with time. However, if there are indeed some FRBs, they will never repeat, then one may reach a certain level of this fraction because some of them just don't repeat and you start to detect them more and more. The intrinsic non-repeaters will increase your denominator continuously. So, and your numerator do not really increase that much. So that's how you reach a peak. But it really depends on a lot of parameters, and that time scale could happen. So the regional peak can happen, say, thousands or 10,000 years. So basically not in our lifetime, not even, definitely not a PhD student's degree time. So, but this is something in principle one can do.
Okay, I see. But that depends on the definition.
Depends a lot of things.
Repeating, right? Like if the repeating time scale, I don't know. Is that the cutoff to be a year or 10 years or?
Yeah, it depends on the repeating time distribution, depending on the luminosity function, on many, many things. But the general feature is there.
Okay, thanks. Any additional question for Dr. Jen? Okay, if not, let's thank Dr. Jen again for this very nice talk.
And thank you all.
Yeah.